Part 2. The Micmac Burying Ground. When Jesus came to Bethany, he found that Lazarus had lain in the grave 4 days already. When Martha heard that Jesus was coming, she hurried to meet him. "Lord," she said, "if you had been here, my brother would not have died. But now you are here, and I know that whatever you ask of God, God will grant." Jesus answered her, "Your brother shall rise again." John's Gospel, paraphrase. "Hey ho, let's go." The Ramones. 36. It's probably wrong to believe there can be any limit to the horror which the human mind can experience. On the contrary, it seems that some exponential effect begins to obtain as deeper and deeper darkness falls. As little as one may like to admit it, human experience tends, in a good many ways, to support the idea that when the nightmare grows black enough, horror spawns horror. One coincidental evil begets other, often more deliberate evils, until finally blackness seems to cover everything. And the most terrifying question of all may be just how much horror the human mind can stand and still maintain a wakeful, staring, unrelenting sanity. That such events have their own Rube Goldberg absurdity goes almost without saying. At some point, it all starts to become rather funny. That may be the point at which sanity begins either to save itself or to buckle and break down. That point at which one's sense of humor begins to reassert itself. Lewis Creed might have harbored such thoughts if he had been thinking rationally following the funeral of his son, Gage William Creed, on the 17th of May. But any rational thought, or attempt at it, ceased at the funeral parlor, where a fistfight with his father-in-law, bad enough, resulted in an event even more terrible. A final bit of outrageous gothic melodrama which shattered whatever remained of Rachel's fragile self-control. That day's penny dreadful events were only complete when she was pulled, screaming, from the east room of the Brookings Smith mortuary, where Gage lay in his closed coffin, and sedated in the foyer by Surendra Hardu. The irony of it was that she would not have experienced that final episode at all, that extravagance of horror, one might say, if the fistfight between Lewis Creed and Mr. Irwin Goldman of Dearborn had taken place at the morning visiting hours, 10 to 11:30 a.m., instead of at the afternoon visiting hours, 2 to 3:30 p.m. Rachel had not been in attendance at the morning visiting hours. She simply had not been able to come. She sat at home with Judd Crandall and Steve Masterton. Lewis had no idea how he ever could have gotten through the previous 48 hours or so without Judd and Steve. It was well for Lewis, well for all three of the remaining family members, that Steve had shown up as promptly as he had, because Lewis was at least temporarily unable to make any kind of decision, even one so minor as giving his wife a shot to mute her deep grief. Lewis hadn't even noticed that Rachel had apparently meant to go to the morning viewing in her housecoat, which she had misbuttoned. Her hair was uncombed, unwashed, tangled. Her eyes, blank brown orbits, bulged from sockets so sunken that they had almost become the eyes of a living skull. Her flesh was doughy. It hung from her face. She sat at the breakfast table that morning, munching unbuttered toast and talking in disjointed phrases that made no sense at all. At one point, she had said abruptly, "About that Winnebago you want to buy, Lou?" Lewis had last spoken about buying a Winnebago in 1981. Lewis only nodded and went on eating his own breakfast. He was having a bowl of Cocoa Bears. Cocoa Bears had been one of Gage's favorite cereals, and this morning Lewis wanted them. The taste of them was appalling, but he still wanted them. He was neatly turned out in his best suit, not black. He didn't have a black suit, but it was at least a deep charcoal gray. He had shaved, showered, and combed his hair. He looked fine, although he was lost in shock. Ellie was dressed in blue jeans and a yellow blouse. She had brought a picture to the breakfast table with her. This picture, an enlargement of a Polaroid Rachel had taken with the SX-70 Lewis and the kids had given her for her last birthday, showed Gage, grinning from the depths of his Sears ski parka, sitting on her speedaway sled as Ellie pulled him. Rachel had caught Ellie looking back over her shoulder and smiling at Gage. Gage was grinning back at her. Ellie carried the picture, but she didn't talk much. Lewis was unable to see the condition of either his wife or his daughter. He ate his breakfast, and his mind replayed the accident over and over and over. Except in this mind movie, the conclusion was different. In the mind movie, he was quicker, and all that happened was that Gage got a spanking for not stopping when they yelled. It was Steve who really saw how it was going with Rachel and with Ellie as well. He forbade Rachel to go to the morning viewing, although viewing was really a misnomer because of the closed coffin. If it was open, Lewis thought, they'd all run screaming from the room, me included, and forbade Ellie to go at all. Rachel protested. Ellie only sat silent and grave with the picture of her and Gage in one hand. It was Steve who gave Rachel the shot she needed and who gave Ellie a teaspoon of a colorless liquid to drink. Ellie usually whined and protested about taking medicine, any kind of medicine, but she drank this silently and without a grimace. By 10 o'clock that morning, she was asleep in her bed, the picture of her and Gage still held in her hand, and Rachel was sitting in front of the television set watching Wheel of Fortune. Her responses to Steve's questions were slow. She was stoned, but her face had lost that thoughtful look of madness which had so worried and frightened the PA when he came in that morning at 8:15. Judd, of course, had made all the arrangements. He made them with the same calm efficiency that he had made them for his wife 3 months before. But it was Steve Masterton who took Lewis aside just before Lewis left for the funeral home. "I'll see that she's there this afternoon if she seems capable of handling it," he told Lewis. "Okay." "The shot will have worn off by then. Your friend Mr. Crandall says he'll stay with Ellie during the afternoon viewing hours." "Right. And play Monopoly or something with her." "Uh-huh. But..." "Right." Steve stopped. They were standing in the garage, Church's stomping ground, the place where he brought his dead birds and dead rats, the ones that Lewis owned. Outside was May sunshine, and a robin bopped across the head of the driveway as if it had important business somewhere. Maybe it did. "Lewis," Steve said, "you've got to get hold of yourself." Lewis looked at Steve, politely questioning. Not much of what Steve had said had gotten through. He'd been thinking that if he had been a little quicker, he could have saved his son's life. But a little of this last registered. "I don't think you've noticed," Steve said, "but Ellie isn't vocalizing. And Rachel has had such a bad shock that her very conception of time seems to have been twisted out of shape." "Right," Lewis said. More force in reply seemed to be indicated here. He wasn't sure why. Steve put a hand on Lewis's shoulder. "Lou," he said, "they need you now more than they ever have in their life. More than they ever will again, maybe. Please, man. I can give your wife a shot, but you... See, Lewis, you gotta..." "Oh, Christ, Lewis, what a cock-knocking, motherfucking mess this is." Lewis saw with something like alarm that Steve was starting to cry. "Sure," he said. And in his mind he saw Gage running across the lawn toward the road. They were yelling at Gage to come back, but he wouldn't. Lately the game had been to run away from Mommy Daddy. And then they were chasing him. Lewis quickly outdistancing Rachel, but Gage had a big lead. Gage was laughing. Gage was running away from Daddy. That was the game. And Lewis was closing the distance, but too slowly. Gage was running down the mild slope of the lawn now to the verge of Route 15, and Lewis prayed to God that Gage would fall down. When little kids ran fast, they almost always fell down because a person's control over his legs didn't really cool until he was maybe 7 or 8. Lewis prayed to God that Gage would fall down, yes, fall down, bloody his nose, crack his skull, need stitches, whatever. Because now he could hear the drone of a truck coming toward them, one of those big 10-wheelers that went back and forth endlessly between Bangor and the Orinco plant in Bucksport. And he had screamed Gage's name then, and he believed that Gage had heard him and tried to stop. Gage seemed to realize that the game was over, that your parents didn't scream at you when it was just a game, and he had tried to put on the brakes, and by then the sound of the truck was very loud, the sound of it filled the world. It was thundering. Lewis had thrown himself forward in a long flying tackle, his shadow tracking the ground beneath him as the shadow of the vulture had tracked the white late winter grass of Mrs. Vint's field that day in March. And he believed that the tips of his fingers had actually brushed the back of the light jacket Gage had been wearing. And then Gage's forward motion had carried him out into the road. And the truck had been thunder. The truck had been sunlight on high chrome. The truck had been the deep-throated, shrieking bellow of an air horn. And that had been Saturday. That had been 3 days ago. "I'm okay," he said to Steve. "I ought to go now." "If you can get yourself together and help them," Steve said, wiping at his eyes with the arm of his jacket, "you'll be helping yourself, too. The three of you have got to get through it together, Lewis. That's the only way. That's all anybody knows." "That's right," Lewis agreed. And in his mind, it all started to happen again, only this time he leaped 2 feet farther right at the end and snagged the back of Gage's jacket, and none of this was happening. At the time the scene in the East Room happened, Ellie was pushing her Monopoly marker aimlessly and silently around the board with Judd Crandall. She shook the dice with one hand and clutched the Polaroid of her pulling Gage on her speedaway sled with the other. Steve Masterton had decided it would be all right for Rachel to attend the afternoon viewing. In light of later developments, it was a decision he came to deeply regret. The Goldmans had flown into Bangor that morning and were staying at the Holiday Inn. Her father had called 4 times by noon, and Steve had to be increasingly firm, almost threatening by call 4 with the old man. Irwin Goldman wanted to come out, and not all the dogs of hell could keep him from his daughter in her time of need, he said. Steve responded that Rachel needed this time before going to the funeral parlor to get over as much of her initial shock as she could. He didn't know about all the dogs of hell, he said, but he knew one Swedish-American physician's assistant that had no intention of allowing anyone into the Creed home until Rachel had appeared in public of her own volition. After the viewing in the afternoon, Steve said, he would be more than happy to let the relative's support system take over. Until then, he wanted her left alone. The old man swore at him in Yiddish and banged the phone down at his end, breaking the connection. Steve waited to see if Goldman would indeed show up, but Goldman had apparently decided to wait. By noon, Rachel did seem a little better. She was at least aware of the time frame she was in, and she had gone out to the kitchen to see if there were sandwich makings or anything for after. "People would probably want to come back to the house after, wouldn't they?" she asked Steve. Steve nodded. There was no bologna or cold roast beef, but there was a butterball turkey in the freezer, and she put it on the drain board to thaw. Steve looked into the kitchen a few minutes later and saw her standing by the sink, looking fixedly at the turkey on the drain board and weeping. "Rachel?" She looked toward Steve. "Gage really liked these. He especially liked the white meat. It was just occurring to me that he was never going to eat another butterball turkey." Steve sent her upstairs to dress, the final test of her ability to cope, really, and when she came down wearing a simple black dress belted at the waist and carrying a small black clutch bag, an evening bag, really, Steve decided she was all right, and Judd concurred. Steve drove her into town. He stood with Surrender Hardu in the lobby of the East Room and watched Rachel drift down the aisle toward the flower-buried coffin like a wraith. "How is it going, Steve?" Surrendra asked quietly. "Going fucking terrible," Steve said in a low, harsh voice. "How did you think it was going?"
"I thought it was probably going fucking terrible," Surrendra said, and sighed.
The trouble really began at the morning viewing, when Irwin Goldman refused to shake hands with his son-in-law. The sight of so many friends and relatives had actually forced Lewis out of the web of shock a little, had forced him to notice what was going on and be outward. He had reached that stage of malleable grief that funeral directors are so used to handling and turning to its best advantage. Lewis was moved around like a counter in a Parcheesi game. Outside the East Room was a small foyer where people could smoke and sit in overstuffed easy chairs.
The chairs looked as if they might have come directly from a distress sale at some old English men's club that had gone broke. Beside the door leading into the viewing room was a small easel, black metal chased with gold, and on this easel was a small sign which said simply, Gage William Creed. If you went across this spacious white building that looked misleadingly like a comfortable old house, you came to an identical foyer, this one outside the West Room, where the sign on the easel read, Alberta Burnham Nadeau. At the back of the house was the riverfront room. The easel to the left of the door between the foyer and this room was blank. It was not in use on this Tuesday morning. Downstairs was the coffin showroom, each model lit by a baby spotlight mounted on the ceiling. If you looked up, Lewis had, and the funeral director had frowned severely at him, it looked as if there were a lot of strange animals roosting up there. Judd had come with him on Sunday, the day after Gage had died, to pick out a coffin. They had gone downstairs, and instead of immediately turning right into the coffin showroom, Lewis, dazed, had continued straight on down the hallway toward a plain white swinging door, the sort you see communicating between restaurant dining rooms and the kitchen. Both Judd and the funeral director had said quickly and simultaneously, "Not that way," and Lewis had followed them away from that swinging door, obediently. He knew what was behind that door, though. His uncle had been an undertaker. The East Room was furnished with neat rows of folding chairs, the expensive ones with plushy seats and backs. At the front, in an area that seemed a combination nave and bower, was Gage's coffin. Lewis had picked the American Casket Company's Rosewood model. Eternal Rest, it was called. It was lined with plushy pink silk. The mortician agreed that it was really a beautiful coffin, and apologized that he did not have one with a blue lining. Lewis responded that he and Rachel had never made such distinctions. The mortician had nodded. The mortician asked Lewis if he had thought about how he would defray the expenses of Gage's funeral. If not, he said, he could take Lewis into his office and quickly go over three of their more popular plans. In Lewis's mind, an announcer suddenly spoke up cheerfully, "I got my kid's coffin free for Raleigh coupons." Feeling like a creature in a dream, he said, "I'm going to pay for everything with my MasterCard." "Fine," the mortician said. The coffin was no more than 4 feet long, a dwarf coffin. Nonetheless, its price was slightly over $600. Lewis supposed it rested on trestles, but the flowers made it difficult to see, and he hadn't wanted to go too close. The smell of all those flowers made him want to gag. At the head of the aisle, just inside the door, giving on to the foyer lounge, was a book on a stand. Chained to the stand was a ballpoint pen. It was here that the funeral director positioned Lewis so he could greet his friends and relatives. The friends and relatives were supposed to sign the book with their names and addresses. Lewis had never had the slightest idea what the purpose of this mad custom might be, and he did not ask now. He supposed that when the funeral was over, he and Rachel would get to keep the book. That seemed the maddest thing of all. Somewhere he had a high school yearbook and a college yearbook and a med school yearbook. There was also a wedding book with My Wedding Day stamped on the imitation leather and imitation gold leaf, beginning with a photo of Rachel trying on her bridal veil before the mirror that morning with her mother's help, and ending with a photo of two pairs of shoes outside a closed hotel door. There was also a baby book for Ellie. They had tired of adding to it rather quickly, though. That one, with its spaces for My First Haircut, add a lock of baby's hair, and Whoops, add a picture of baby falling on her ass, had been just too relentlessly cute. Now, added to all the others, this one. "What do we call it?" Lewis wondered as he stood numbly beside the stand waiting for the party to begin. "My death book? Funeral autographs? The day we planted Gage? Or maybe something more dignified, like a death in the family?" He turned the book back to its cover, which, like the cover to the My Wedding Day book, was imitation leather. The cover was blank. Almost predictably, Missy Dandridge had been the first to arrive that morning. Good-hearted Missy, who had sat with Ellie and Gage on dozens of occasions, Lewis found himself remembering that it had been Missy who had taken the kids on the evening of the day Victor Pascal had died. She had taken the kids, and Rachel had made love to him, first in the tub, then in bed. Missy had been crying, crying hard, and at the sight of Lewis's calm, still face, she burst into fresh tears and reached for him, seemed to grope for him. Lewis embraced her, realizing that this was the way it worked, or the way it was supposed to work anyway, some kind of human charge that went back and forth, loosening up the hard earth of loss, venting it, breaking up the rocky path of shock with the heat of sorrow. "I'm so sorry," Missy was saying, brushing her dark blonde hair back from her pallid face. "Such a dear, sweet little boy. I loved him so much, Lewis. I'm so sorry. It's an awful road. I hope they put that truck driver in jail forever. He was going much too fast. He was so sweet, so dear, so bright. Why would God take Gage? I don't know. We can't understand, can we? But I'm sorry, sorry, so sorry." Lewis comforted her, held her, and comforted her. He felt her tears on his collar, the press of her breasts against him. She wanted to know where Rachel was, and Lewis told her that Rachel was resting. Missy promised to go see her, and that she would sit with Ellie any time, for as long as they needed her. Lewis thanked her. She had started away, still sniffing, her eyes redder than ever above her black handkerchief. She was moving toward the coffin when Lewis called her back. The funeral director, whose name Lewis could not even remember, had told him to have them sign the book, and damned if he wasn't going to have them do it. "Mystery guest, sign in, please," he thought, and came very close to going off into cackles of bright, hysterical laughter. It was Missy's woeful, heartbroken eyes that drove the laughter away. "Missy, would you sign the book?" he asked her, and because something else seemed to be needed, he added, "For Rachel." "Of course," she said, "poor Lewis and poor Rachel." And suddenly Lewis knew what she was going to say next, and for some reason he dreaded it. Yet it was coming, unavoidable, like a black bullet of a large caliber from a killer's gun, and he knew that he would be struck over and over by this bullet in the next interminable 90 minutes. And then again in the afternoon, while the wounds of the morning were still trickling blood. "Thank God he didn't suffer, Lewis. At least it was quick." "Yes, it was quick, all right," he thought about saying to her. Ah, how that would shatter her face all over again, and he felt a vicious urge to do it, to simply spray the words into her face. "It was quick, no doubt about that. That's why the coffin's closed. Nothing could have been done about Gage, even if Rachel and I approved of dressing up dead relatives in their best, like department store mannequins, and rouging and powdering and painting their faces. It was quick, Missy, my dear. One minute he was there on the road, and the next minute he was lying in it, but way down by the ringer's house. It hit him and killed him, and then it dragged him, and you better believe it was quick. 100 yards or more, all told, the length of a football field. I ran after him, Missy. I was screaming his name over and over again, almost as if I expected he would still be alive. Me, a doctor. I ran 10 yards, and there was his baseball cap. And I ran 20 yards, and there was one of his Star Wars sneakers. I ran 40 yards, and by then the truck had run off the road, and the box had jackknifed in that field beyond the ringer's barn. People were coming out of their houses, and I went on screaming his name, Missy. And at the 50-yard line, there was his jumper. It was turned inside out. And on the 70-yard line, there was the other sneaker. And then there was Gage. Abruptly, the world went dove gray. Everything passed out of his view. Dimly, he could feel the corner of the stand which held the book dig into his palm, but that was all. "Lewis?" Missy's voice, distant, the mystery sound of pigeons in his ears. "Lewis?" Closer now, alarmed. The world swam back into focus. "You all right?" He smiled. "Fine," he said. "I'm okay, Missy." She signed for herself and her husband, Mr. and Mrs. David Dandridge, in round Palmer method script. To this she added their address, Rural Box 67, Old Bucksport Road, and then raised her eyes to Lewis's and quickly dropped them, as if her very address on the road where Gage had died constituted a crime. "Be well, Lewis," she whispered. David Dandridge shook his hand and muttered something inarticulate. His prominent, arrowhead-shaped Adam's apple bobbing up and down. Then he followed his wife hurriedly down the aisle for the ritual examination of a coffin which had been made in Storyville, Ohio, a place where Gage had never been, and where he was not known. Following the Dandridges, they all came, moving in a shuffling line, and Lewis received them, their handshakes, their hugs, their tears. His collar and the upper sleeve of his dark gray suit coat soon became quite damp. The smell of the flowers began to reach even the back of the room and to permeate the place with the smell of funeral. It was a smell he remembered from his childhood, that sweet, thick mortuary smell of flowers. Lewis was told how merciful it was that Gage hadn't suffered 32 times by his own inner count. He was told that God works in mysterious ways his wonders to perform 25 times. Bringing up the rear was, he's with the angels now, a total of 12 times. It began to get to him. Instead of losing what marginal sense these little aphorisms had, the way your own name will lose its sense and identity if you repeat it over and over again, they seemed to punch deeper each time, angling in toward the vitals. By the time his mother-in-law and father-in-law put in their inevitable appearance, he began to feel like a hard-tagged fighter. His first thought was that Rachel had been right. And how? Erwin Goldman had indeed aged. He was, what, 58, 59? Today he looked like a graven and composed 70. He looked almost absurdly like Israel's Prime Minister Menachem Begin with his bald head and Coke bottle glasses. Rachel had told Lewis Goldman had aged when she came back from her Thanksgiving trip. But Lewis had not expected this. Of course, he thought maybe it hadn't been this bad at Thanksgiving. The old man hadn't lost one of his two grandchildren at Thanksgiving. Dory walked beside him, her face all but invisible under two, possibly three layers of heavy black netting. Her hair was fashionably blue, the color favored by elderly ladies of an upper-class American persuasion. She held her husband's arm. All Lewis could really see behind the veil was the glitter of her tears. Suddenly he decided it was time to let bygones be bygones. He could not hold the old grudge any longer. Suddenly it was too heavy. Perhaps it was the cumulative weight of all those platitudes. "Erwin, Dory," he murmured, "thank you for coming." He made a gesture with his arms, as if to shake hands with Rachel's father and hug her mother simultaneously, or perhaps even to hug them both. Either way, he felt his own tears start for the first time, and for an instant he had the crazy idea that they could mend all their fences, that Gage would do that much for them in his dying, as if this were some romantic lady's novel he had stepped into where the wages of death were reconciliation, where it could cause something more constructive than this endless, stupid, grinding ache which just went on and on and on. Dory started toward him, making a gesture, beginning, perhaps, to hold out her own arms. She said something, "Oh, Lewis," and something else that was garbled, and then Goldman pulled his wife back. For a moment, the three of them stood in a tableau that no one noticed except themselves, unless perhaps the funeral director, standing unobtrusively in the far corner of the East Room, saw. Lewis supposed that Uncle Carl would have seen. Lewis, with his arms partly outstretched, Erwin and Dory Goldman standing as stiff and straight as a couple on a wedding cake. Lewis saw that there were no tears in his father-in-law's eyes. They were bright and clear with hate. "Does he think I killed Gage to spite him?" Lewis wondered. Those eyes seemed to measure Lewis, to find him the same small and pointless man who had kidnapped his daughter and brought her to this sorrow, and then to dismiss him. His eyes shifted to Lewis's left, to Gage's coffin, in fact, and only then did they soften. Still, Lewis made a final effort. "Erwin," he said, "Dory, please, we have to get together on this." "Lewis," Dory said again, kindly, Lewis thought, and then they were past him. Erwin Goldman, perhaps pulling his wife along, not looking to the left or the right, certainly not looking at Lewis Creed. They approached the coffin, and Goldman fumbled a small black skull cap out of his suit coat pocket. "You didn't sign the book," Lewis thought, and then a silent belch of such malignantly acidic content rose through his digestive works that his face clenched in pain. The morning viewing ended at last. Lewis called home. Judd answered and asked him how it had gone. All right, Lewis said. He asked Judd if he could talk to Steve. If she can dress herself, I'm going to let her come this afternoon, Steve said. Okay by you? Yes, Lewis said. How are you, Lou? No bullshit and straight on. How are you? All right, Lewis said briefly. Coping. I had all of them sign the book. All of them except Dory and Irwin. And they wouldn't. All right, Steve said. Look, shall we meet you for lunch? Lunch. Meeting for lunch. This seemed such an alien idea that Lewis thought of the science fiction novels he had read as a teenager. Novels by Robert A. Heinlein, Murray Leinster, Gordon R. Dixon. The natives here on Planet Quark have an odd custom. When one of their children dies, Lieutenant Abelson, they meet for lunch. I know how grotesque and barbaric that sounds, but remember, this planet has not been terraformed yet. Sure, Lewis said. What's a good restaurant for halftime between funeral viewings, Steve? Take it easy, Lou, Steve said, but he didn't seem entirely displeased. In this state of crazy calm, Lewis felt better able to see into people than ever before in his life. Perhaps it was an illusion, but right now he suspected Steve was thinking that even a sudden spate of sarcasm, squirted out like an abrupt mouthful of bile, was preferable to his earlier state of disconnection. Don't worry, he said to Steve now. What about Benjamin's? Sure, Steve said. Benjamin's would be fine. He had made the call from the office of the funeral director. Now, as Lewis passed the east room on his way out, he saw that the room was almost empty. But Irwin and Dory Goldman sat down in the front row, heads bowed. They looked to Lewis as if they might sit there forever. Benjamin's was the right choice. Bangor was an early lunch town, and around 1 o'clock it was nearly deserted. Judd had come along with Steve and Rachel, and the four of them ate fried chicken. At one point, Rachel went to the ladies' room and remained in there so long that Steve became nervous. He was on the verge of asking a waitress to check on her when she came back to the table, her eyes red. Lewis picked at his chicken and drank a lot of Schlitz beer. Judd matched him bottle for bottle, not talking much. Their four meals went back almost uneaten, and with his preternatural insight, Lewis saw the waitress, a fat girl with a pretty face, debating with herself about whether or not to ask them if their meals had been all right, finally taking another look at Rachel's red-rimmed eyes, and deciding it would be the wrong question. Over coffee, Rachel said something so suddenly and so boldly that it rather shocked them all, particularly Lewis, who at last was becoming sleepy with the beer. I'm going to give his clothes to the Salvation Army. Are you? Steve said after a moment. Yes, Rachel said. There's a lot of wear in them yet. All his jumpers, his corduroy pants, his shirts. Someone will be glad to get them. They're all very serviceable, except for the ones he was wearing, of course. They're ruined. The last word became a miserable choke. She tried to drink coffee, but that was no good. A moment later, she was sobbing into her hands. There was a queer moment then. They were crossing lines of tension then. They all seemed to focus on Lewis. He felt this with the same preternatural insight he'd had all this day. And of them all, this was the clearest and surest. Even the waitress felt those converging lines of awareness. He saw her pause at a table near the back where she was laying placemats and silver. For a moment, Lewis was puzzled, and then he understood. They were waiting for him to comfort his wife. He couldn't do it. He wanted to do it. He understood it was his responsibility to do it. All the same, he couldn't. It was the cat that got in his way. Suddenly, and with no rhyme or reason, the cat, the fucking cat, Church with his ripped mice and the birds he had grounded forever. When he found them, Lewis had cleaned up the messes promptly with no complaint or comment, certainly without protest. He had, after all, bought them. But had he bought this? He saw his fingers. Lewis saw his fingers. He saw his fingers lightly skating over the back of Gage's jacket. Then Gage's jacket had been gone. Then Gage had been gone. He looked into his coffee cup and let his wife cry beside him, uncomforted. After a moment, in terms of clock time, probably quite short, but both then and in retrospect it seemed long, Steve put an arm around her and hugged her gently. His eyes on Lewis's were reproachful and angry. Lewis turned from them toward Judd, but Judd was looking down as if in shame. There was no help there. 37. I knew something like this would happen, Irwin Goldman said. That was how the trouble started. I knew it when she buried you. You'll have all the grief you can stand and more, I said. And look at this. Look at this. This mess. Lewis looked slowly around at his father-in-law, who had appeared before him like some malign jack-in-the-box in a skullcap. And then, instinctively, he looked around at where Rachel had been, by the book on the stand. The afternoon shift was hers by default, but Rachel was gone. The afternoon viewing had been less crowded, and after half an hour or so, Lewis had gone down to the front row of seats and sat there on the aisle, aware of very little, only peripherally aware of the cloying stink of the flowers, except the fact that he was very tired and sleepy. It was only partly the beer, he supposed. His mind was finally ready to shut down. Probably a good thing. Perhaps after 12 or 16 hours of sleep, he would be able to comfort Rachel a little. After a while, his head had sunk until he was looking at his hands, loosely linked between his knees. The hum of voices near the back was soothing. He'd been relieved to see that Irwin and Dury weren't here when the four of them returned from lunch. But he should have known their continued absence was too good to be true. "Where's Rachel?" Lewis asked now. "With her mother. Where she should be." Goldman spoke with the studied triumph of a man who has closed a big deal. There was scotch on his breath, a lot of it. He stood before Lewis like a banty little district attorney before a man in the bar of justice, a man who was patently guilty. He was unsteady on his feet. "What did you say to her?" Lewis said, feeling the beginnings of alarm now. He knew Goldman had said something. It was in the man's face. "Nothing but the truth. I told her this is what it gets you, marrying against your parents' wishes. I told her..." "Did you say that?" Lewis asked incredulously. "You didn't really say that, did you?"
"That and more," Irwin Goldman said. "I always knew it would come to this. This or something like it. I knew what kind of a man you were the first time I saw you."
He leaned forward, exhaling scotch fumes.
"I saw through you, you prancing little fraud of a doctor. You enticed my daughter into a stupid, feckless marriage, and you turned her into a scullery maid, and then you let her son be run down in the highway like a chipmunk."
Most of this went over Lewis's head. He was still groping with the idea that this stupid little man could have...
"You said that to her?" he repeated. "You said it?" "I hope you rot in hell," Goldman said,
and heads turned sharply toward the sound of his voice. Tears began to squeeze out of Irwin Goldman's bloodshot brown eyes. His bald head glowed under the muted fluorescent lights.
"You made my wonderful daughter into a scullery maid, destroyed her future, took her away, and let my grandson die a dirty death in a country road."
His voice rose to a hectoring scream.
"Where were you? Sitting on your ass while he was playing in the road? Thinking about your stupid medical articles? What were you doing, you shit? You stinking shit, killer of children, kid?"
There they were. There they were at the front of the East Room. There they were, and Lewis saw his arm go out. He saw the sleeve of his suit coat pull back from the cuff of his white shirt. He saw the mellow gleam of one cufflink. Rachel had given him the set for their third wedding anniversary, never knowing that her husband would someday wear these cufflinks to the funeral ceremonies of their then-unborn son. His fist was just something tied to the end of his arm. It connected with Goldman's mouth. He felt the old man's lips squash and splay back. It was a sickening feeling, really. Squashing a slug with your fist might feel something like that. There was no satisfaction in it. Beneath the flesh of his father-in-law's lips, he could feel the stern, unyielding regularity of his dentures. Goldman went stumbling backward. His arm came down against Gage's coffin, knocking it aslant. One of the vases, top-heavy with flowers, fell over with a crash. Someone screamed. It was Rachel, struggling with her mother, who was trying to hold her back. The people who were there, 10 or 15 in all, seemed frozen between fright and embarrassment. Steve had taken Judd back to Ludlow, and Lewis was dimly grateful for that. This was not a scene he would have wished Judd to witness. It was unseemly.
"Don't hurt him!" Rachel screamed. "Lewis, don't hurt my father!"
"You like to hit old men, do you?"
Irwin Goldman of the overflowing checkbook cried out shrilly. He was grinning through a mouthful of blood.
"You like to hit old men? I am not surprised, you stinking bastard. That does not surprise me at all."
Lewis turned toward him, and Goldman struck him in the neck. There was a clumsy, side-handed chopping blow, but Lewis was unprepared for it. A paralyzing pain that would make it hard for him to swallow for the next 2 hours exploded in his throat. His head rocked back, and he fell to one knee in the aisle.
"First the flowers, now me," he thought. "What is it the Ramones say? Hey-ho, let's go."
He thought he wanted to laugh, but there was no laugh in him. What came out of his hurt throat was a little groan. Rachel screamed again. Irwin Goldman, his mouth dripping blood, marched over to where his son-in-law kneeled and kicked Lewis smartly in the kidneys. The pain was a bright flare of agony. He put his hands down on the rug runner to keep from going flop on his belly.
"You don't do so good even against old men, sonny," Goldman cried with cracked excitement.
He kicked out at Lewis again, missing the kidney this time, getting Lewis on the high part of the left buttock with one black old man's shoe. Lewis grunted in pain, and this time he did go down on the carpet. His chin hit with an audible crack. He bit his tongue.
"There!" Goldman cried. "There's the kick in the ass I should have given you the first time you came sucking around, you bastard. There!"
He kicked Lewis in the ass again, this time connecting with the other buttock. He was weeping and grinning. Lewis saw for the first time that Goldman was unshaven, a sign of mourning. The funeral director raced toward them. Rachel had broken Mrs. Goldman's hold and was also racing toward them, screaming. Lewis rolled clumsily over on his side and sat up. His father-in-law kicked out at him again, and Lewis caught his shoe in both hands. It thwopped solidly into his palms like a well-caught football and shoved backward as hard as he could. Bellowing, Goldman flew backward at an angle, pinwheeling his arms for balance. He fell on Gage's Eternal Rest casket, which had been manufactured in the town of Storyville, Ohio, and which had not come cheap.
"Oz, the great and terrible, has just fallen on top of my son's coffin," Lewis thought dazedly.
The casket fell from the trestle with a huge crash. The left end fell first, then the right. The latch snapped. Even over the screams and the crying, even over the bellows of Goldman, who, after all, was only playing a children's party game of pin the blame on the donkey, Lewis heard the lock snap. The coffin did not actually open and spill Gage's sad, hurt remains out onto the floor for all of them to gawp at. But Lewis was sickly aware that they had only been spared that by the way the coffin had fallen. On its bottom, instead of on its side, it easily could have fallen that other way. Nonetheless, in that split instant before the lid slammed shut on its broken latch again, he saw a flash of gray, the suit they had bought to put in the ground around Gage's body, and a bit of pink. Gage's hand, maybe. Sitting there on the floor, Lewis put his face in his hands and began to weep. He'd lost all interest in his father-in-law, in the MX missile, in permanent versus dissolving sutures, in the heat death of the universe. At that moment, Lewis Creed wished he were dead. And suddenly, weirdly, an image rose in his mind. Gage in Mickey Mouse ears. Gage laughing and shaking hands with a great big Goofy on Main Street in Disney World. He saw this with utter clarity. One of the trestle supports had fallen over. The other leaned with a drunken casualness against the low dais where a minister might stand to offer a eulogy. Sprawled in the flowers was Goldman, also weeping. Water from the overturned vases trickled. The flowers, some of them crushed and mangled, gave off their turgid scent even more strongly. Rachel was screaming and screaming. Lewis could not respond to her screams. The image of Gage and Mickey Mouse ears was fading, but not before he heard a voice announcing there would be fireworks later that evening. He sat with his face in his hands, not wanting them to see him anymore. His tear-stained face, his loss, his guilt, his pain, his shame, most of all his cowardly wish to be dead and out of this blackness. The funeral director and Dory Goldman led Rachel out. She was still screaming. Later on, in another room, one that Lewis assumed was reserved especially for those overcome with grief, the hysterics parlor, perhaps, she became very silent. Lewis himself, dazed but sane and in control, sedated her this time, after insisting that the two of them be left alone. At home, he led her up to bed and gave her another shot. Then he pulled the covers up to her chin and regarded her waxy, pallid face. "Rachel, I'm sorry," he said. "I'd give anything in the world to take that back." "It's all right," she said in a strange, flat voice, and then rolled over on her side, turning away from him. He heard the tired, old question, "Are you all right?" rising to his lips, and pushed it back. It wasn't a true question. It wasn't what he really wanted to know. "How bad are you?" he asked finally. "Pretty bad, Lewis," she said, and then uttered a sound that could have been a laugh. "I am terrible, in fact." Something more seemed required, but Lewis could not supply it. He felt suddenly resentful of her, of Steve Masterton, of Missy Dandridge and her husband with his arrow-shaped Adam's apple, of the whole damned crew. Why should he have to be the eternal supplier? What sort of shit was that? He turned off the light and left. He found that he could not give much more to his daughter. For one wild moment, regarding her in her shadowy room, he thought she was Gage. The thought came to him that the whole thing had been a hideous nightmare, like his dream of Pascal leading him into the woods, and for a moment his tired mind grasped at it. The shadows helped. There was only the shifting light of the portable TV that Judd had taken up for her to pass the hours. The long, long hours. But it wasn't Gage, of course. It was Ellie, who was now not only grasping the picture in which she was pulling Gage on the sled, but sitting in Gage's chair. She had taken it out of his room and brought it into hers. It was a small director's chair with a canvas seat and a canvas strip across the back. Stenciled across that strip was Gage. Rachel had mail-ordered four of these chairs. Each member of the family had one with his or her name stenciled on the back. Ellie was too big for Gage's chair. She was crammed into it, and the canvas bottom bulged downward dangerously. She held the Polaroid picture to her chest and stared at the TV where some movie was showing. "Ellie," he said, snapping off the TV. "Bedtime." She worked her way out of the chair, then folded it up. She apparently meant to take the chair into bed with her. Lewis hesitated, wanting to say something about the chair, and finally settled on, "Do you want me to tuck you in?" "Yes, please," she said. Would you want to sleep with Mommy tonight?" "No, thanks." "You sure?" She smiled a little. "Yes. She steals the covers." Lewis smiled back. "Come on, then." Instead of trying to put the chair in bed with her, Ellie unfolded it by the head of the bed, and an absurd image came to Lewis. Here was the consulting room of the world's smallest psychiatrist. She undressed, putting the picture of her and Gage on her pillow to do it. She put on her baby doll pajamas, picked up the picture, went into the bathroom, put it down to wash up, brush, floss, and to take her fluoride tablet. Then she picked it up again and got into bed with it. Lewis sat down beside her and said, "I want you to know, Ellie, that if we keep on loving each other, we can get through this." Each word was like moving a handcar loaded with wet bales, and the total effort left Lewis feeling exhausted. "I'm going to wish really hard," Ellie said calmly, "and pray to God for Gage to come back." "Ellie, God can take it back if he wants to," Ellie said. "He can do anything he wants to." "Ellie, God doesn't do things like that," Lewis said uneasily. And in his mind's eye, he saw Church squatting on the closed lid of the toilet, staring at him with those muddy eyes as Lewis lay in the tub. "He does so," she said. "In Sunday school, the teacher told us about this guy Lazarus. He was dead, and Jesus brought him back to life. He said, 'Lazarus, come forth,' and the teacher said if he'd just said, 'Come forth,' probably everybody in that graveyard would have come out, and Jesus only wanted Lazarus." An absurdity popped out of his mouth. But the day had sung and gibbered with absurdity. That was a long time ago, Ellie. I'm going to keep things ready for him, she said. I've got his picture, and I'm going to sit in his chair.
Ellie, you're too big for Gage's chair, Lewis said, taking her hot, feverish hand. You'll break it.
God will help it not to break, Ellie said. Her voice was serene, but Lewis observed the brown half-moons under her eyes. Looking at her made his heart ache so badly that he turned away from her. Maybe when Gage's chair broke, she would begin to understand what had happened a little better.
I'm going to carry the picture and sit in his chair, she said. I'm going to eat his breakfast, too.
Gage and Ellie had each had their own breakfast cereals. Gage's, Ellie had once claimed, tasted like dead boogers. If Cocoa Bears was the only cereal in the house, Ellie would sometimes eat a boiled egg, or nothing at all.
I'll eat lima beans, even though I hate them. And I'll read all of Gage's picture books, and I'll get things ready. In case.
She was crying now. Lewis did not try to comfort her, but only brushed her hair back from her forehead. What she was talking about made a certain crazed sense. Keeping the lines open. Keeping things current. Keeping Gage in the present. In the hot 100. Refusing to let him recede. Remember when Gage did this, or that? Yeah, that was great. Good old Gage, what a kid. When it started not to hurt, it started not to matter. She understood, perhaps, Lewis thought, how easy it would be to let Gage be dead.
Ellie, don't cry anymore, he said. This isn't forever.
She cried forever. For 15 minutes, she actually fell asleep before her tears stopped. But eventually she slept, and downstairs the clock struck 10 in the quiet house.
Keep him alive, Ellie, if that's what you want, he thought, and kissed her. The shrinks would probably say it's as unhealthy as hell, but I'm for it, because I know the day will come, maybe as soon as this Friday, when you forget to carry the picture, and I'll see it lying on your bed in this empty room while you ride your bike around the driveway, or walk in the field behind the house, or go over to Kathy McGowan's house to make clothes with her so perfect. Gage won't be with you. And that's when Gage drops off whatever hot 100 there is that exists in little girls' hearts and starts to become something that happened in 1984. A blast from the past. Lewis left the room and stood for a moment at the head of the stairs, thinking, not seriously, about going to bed. He knew what he needed and went downstairs to get it. Lewis Albert Creed set methodically about getting drunk. Downstairs in the cellar were 5 cases of Schlitz light beer. Lewis drank beer, Judd drank it, Steve Masterton drank it, Missy Dandridge would occasionally have a beer or two while watching the kids. Kid, Lewis reminded himself, going down the cellar stairs. Even Charlton, on the few occasions she had come over to the house, preferred a beer, as long as it was a light beer, to a glass of wine. So one day last winter, Rachel had gone out and bought a staggering 10 cases when Schlitz Light went on sale at the Brewer A&P. Stop you running down to Julio's in Arrington every time somebody drops in, she had said. And you're always quoting Robert Parker to me, love. Any beer that's in the refrigerator after the store is closed is good beer, right? So drink this and think about the dough you're saving. Last winter, when things had been okay... When things had been okay. It was funny how quickly and easily her mind made that crucial division. Lewis brought up a case of beer and shoved the cans into the fridge. Then he took one can, closed the fridge door, and opened the beer. Church came oiling slowly and rustily out of the pantry at the sound of the refrigerator door and stared inquiringly up at Lewis. The cat did not come too close. Lewis had perhaps kicked it too many times. Nothing for you, he told the cat. You had your can of callow today. If you want something else, go kill a bird. Church stood there, looking up at him. Lewis drank off half the can of beer and felt it go to his head almost at once. You don't even eat them, do you? He asked. Just killing them is enough for you. Church strolled into the living room, apparently deciding there was going to be no food, and after a moment, Lewis followed it. He thought again randomly,
Hey-ho, let's go. Lewis sat down in his chair and looked at Church again. The cat was reclining on the rug by the TV stand, watching Lewis carefully, probably ready to run if Lewis should suddenly become aggressive and decide to put his kicking foot in gear. Instead, Lewis raised his beer. "To Gage," he said. "To my son, who might have been an artist, or an Olympic swimmer, or the motherfucking President of the United States. What do you say, asshole?" Church regarded him with those dull, strange eyes. Lewis drank off the rest of his beer in big gulps that hurt his tender throat, arose, went to the fridge, and got a second one. By the time Lewis had finished three beers, he felt that he had some sort of equilibrium for the first time that day. By the time he had gotten through the first six-pack, he felt that sleep might actually be possible in another hour or so. He came back from the fridge with his eighth or ninth. He had really lost count by then and was walking on a slant. And his eyes fell on Church. The cat was dozing, or pretending to, on the rug now. The thought came so naturally that it surely must have been there all along, simply waiting its time to come forward from the back of his mind. "When are you going to do it? When are you going to bury Gage in the annex to the pet cemetery?" And on the heels of that, "Lazarus, come forth." Ellie's sleepy, dazed voice. "The teacher said if he'd just said, 'Come forth,' probably everybody in that graveyard would have come out." A chill of such elemental force struck him that Lewis clutched himself as the shudder twisted through his body. He suddenly found himself remembering Ellie's first day of school, how Gage had gone to sleep on his lap while he and Rachel were listening to Ellie prattle on about old MacDonald and Mrs. Berryman. He had said, "Just let me put the baby to bed." And when he took Gage upstairs, a horrible premonition had struck him. And now he understood. Back in September, part of him had known Gage was going to die soon. Part of him had known that Oz, the great and terrible, was at hand. It was nonsense. It was rot. It was superstitious bullshit of the purest ray serene. And it was true. He had known. Lewis spilled some of his beer on his shirt, and Church looked up wearily to see if this was a signal that the evening's cat-kicking festivities were about to commence. Lewis suddenly remembered the question he had asked Judd. He remembered the way Judd's arm had jerked, knocking two empty beer bottles off the table. One of them had shattered. "You don't even want to talk about such things, Lewis." But he did want to talk about them, or at least think about them. The pet cemetery. What was beyond the pet cemetery? The idea had a deadly attraction. It made a balance of logic which was impossible to deny. Church had been killed in the road. Gage had been killed in the road. Here was Church, changed, of course, distasteful in some ways, but here. Ellie, Gage, and Rachel all had a working relationship with him. He killed birds, true, and had turned a few mice inside out. But killing small animals was a cat thing to do. Church had by no means turned into Frankencat. He was, in many ways, as good as ever. "You're rationalizing," a voice whispered. "He's not as good as ever. He's spooky. The crow, Lewis. Remember the crow?" "Good God," Lewis said aloud in a shaky, distracted voice he was barely able to recognize as his own. "God, oh yes, fine, sure. If there had ever been a time to invoke the name of God outside of a novel about ghosts or vampires, this was it. So just what in the name of God was he thinking about? Was he thinking about a dark blasphemy, which he was even now not wholly able to credit? Worse, he was telling himself lies. Not just rationalizing, but outright lying. So what's the truth? You want the truth so fucking bad, what's the truth? That Church wasn't really a cat anymore at all. Start with that. He looked like a cat. He acted like a cat. But he was really only a poor imitation. People couldn't actually see through that imitation, but they could feel through it.
He remembered a night when Charlton had been at the house. The occasion had been a small pre-Christmas dinner party. They'd been sitting in here, talking after the meal, and Church had jumped up in her lap. Charlton had pushed the cat off immediately, a quick and instinctive moo of distaste, puckering her mouth. It had been no big deal. No one had even commented on it. But it was there. Charlton had felt what the cat wasn't. Lewis killed his beer and went back for another. If Gage came back changed in such a way, that would be an obscenity. He popped the top and drank deeply. He was drunk now, drunk for fair, and there would be a big head for him to deal with tomorrow. How I Went to My Son's Funeral with a Hangover, by Lewis Creed, author of How I Just Missed Him at the Crucial Moment, and numerous other works. Drunk. Sure. And he suspected now that the reason he had gotten drunk was so he could consider this crazy idea soberly. In spite of everything, the idea had that deadly attraction, that sick luster, that glamour. Yes, that above all else, it had glamour. Judd was back, speaking in his mind. You do it because it gets hold of you. You do it because that burial place is a secret place, and you want to share the secret. You make up reasons. They seem like good reasons, but mostly you do it because you want to, or because you have to. Judd's voice, low and drawling with Yankee intonation. Judd's voice chilling his flesh, bringing out the goosebumps, making the hackles on the back of his neck rise. These are secret things, Lewis. The soil of a man's heart is stonier, like the soil up in the old Micmac burying ground. A man grows what he can, and he tends it. Lewis began to go over the other things Judd had told him about the Micmac burying ground. He began to collate the data, to sort through it, to compress it. He proceeded in exactly the same way he had once readied himself for big exams. The dog, Spot. I could see all the places where the barbed wire had hooked him. There was no fur in any of those places, and the flesh looked dimpled in. The bull. Another file turned over in Lewis's mind. Lester Morgan buried his prize bull up there. Black Angus bull, named Hanratty. Lester dragged him all the way up there on a sledge. Shot him dead 2 weeks later. That bull turned mean, really mean. But he's the only animal I ever heard of that did. He turned mean. The soil of a man's heart is stonier. He turned really mean. He's the only animal I ever heard of that did. Mostly you do it because once you've been up there, it's your place. The flesh looked dimpled in. Hanratty, ain't that a silly name for a bull? The man grows what he can, and tends it. They're my rats, and my birds. I bought the fuckers. It's your place, a secret place, and it belongs to you. And you belong to it. He turned mean, but he's the only animal I ever heard of that did. What do you want to buy next, Lewis? When the wind blows hard at night and the moon lays a white path through the woods to that place. Want to climb those stairs again? When they're watching a horror movie, everyone in the audience knows the hero or the heroine is stupid to go up those stairs. But in real life, they always do. They smoke. They don't wear seatbelts. They move their family in beside a busy highway where the big rigs drone back and forth all day and all night. So, Lewis, what do you say? Want to climb the stairs? Would you like to keep your dead son? Or go for what's behind door number one, door number two, or door number three? Hey-ho, let's go. Turned mean. Only animal. The flesh looked... A man. Yours. His. Lewis dumped the rest of the beard down the sink, feeling suddenly that he was going to vomit. The room was moving around in great swinging motions. There was a knock at the door. For a long time, It seemed like a long time anyway. He believed it was only in his head, a hallucination. But the knocking just went on and on, patient, implacable. And suddenly Lewis found himself thinking of the story of the monkey's paw, and a cold terror slipped into him. He seemed to feel it with total physical reality. It was like a dead hand that had been kept in a refrigerator, a dead hand which had suddenly taken on its own disembodied life and slipped inside his shirt to clutch the flesh over his heart. It was a silly image, fulsome and silly, but oh, it didn't feel silly, no. Lewis went to the door on feet he could not feel and lifted the latch with nerveless fingers. As he swung it open, he thought, it'll be Pascal. Like they said about Jim Morrison, back from the dead and bigger than ever. Pascal standing there in his jogging shorts, big as life and as moldy as month-old bread. Pascal with his horribly ruined head. Pascal bringing the warning again. Don't go up there. What was that old song by the Animals? Baby, please don't go. Baby, please don't go. You know I love you, so baby, please don't go. The door swung open, and standing there on his front step in the blowing dark of this midnight, between the day of the funeral parlor visitation and the day of his son's burial, was Judd Crandall. His thin white hair blew randomly in the chilly dark. Lewis tried to laugh. Time seemed to have turned cleverly back on itself. It was Thanksgiving again. Soon they would put the stiff, unnaturally thickened body of Ellie's cat, Winston Churchill, into a plastic garbage bag and start off. Oh, do not ask what it is. Let us go and make our visit. Can I come in, Lewis? Judd asked. He took a bag of Chesterfields from his shirt pocket and poked one into his mouth. Tell you what, Lewis said. It's late, and I've been drinking a pile of beer. Yeah, I could smell it, Judd said. He struck a match. The wind snuffed it. He struck another around cupped hands, but the hands trembled and betrayed the match to the wind again. He got a third match, prepared to strike it, and then looked up at Lewis, standing in the doorway. I can't get this thing lit, Judd said. Gonna let me in or not, Lewis? Lewis stepped aside and let Judd walk in. 38. They sat at the kitchen table over beers. First time we've ever tipped one in our kitchen, Lewis thought, a little surprised. Halfway across the living room, Ellie had cried out in her sleep, and both of them had frozen like statues in a children's game. The cry had not been repeated. Okay, Lewis said. What are you doing over here at 12:15 on the morning my son gets buried? You're a friend, Judd, but this is stretching it. Judd drank, wiped his mouth with the heel of his hand, and looked directly at Lewis. There was something clear and positive in his eyes, and Lewis, at last, looked down from it. You know why I'm here, Judd said. You're thinking about things that are not to be thought of, Lewis. Worse still, I fear you're considering them. I wasn't thinking about anything but going to bed, Lewis said. I have a burying to go to tomorrow. I'm responsible for more pain in your heart than you should have tonight, Judd said softly. For all I know, I may even have been responsible for the death of your son. Lewis looked up, startled. What? Judd, don't talk crazy. You are thinking of trying to put him up there, Judd said. Don't you deny the thought has crossed your mind, Lewis? Lewis did not reply. How far does its influence extend? Judd said. Can you tell me that? No. I can't answer that question myself, and I've lived my whole life in this patch of the world. I know about the Micmacs, and that place was always considered to be a kind of holy place to them, but not in a good way. Stanny B. told me that. My father told me, too, later on, after Spot died the second time. Now, the Micmacs, the state of Maine, and the government of the United States are arguing in court about who owns that land. Who does own it? No one really knows, Lewis. Not anymore. Different people laid claim to it at one time or another, but no claim ever stuck. Anson Ludlow, the great-grandson of this town's founding father, for one. His claim is maybe the best for a white man, since Joseph Ludlow the Elder had the whole shebang as a grant from good King George back when Maine was just a big province of the Massachusetts Bay Colony. But even then, he would have been in a hell of a court fight, because there was cross-claims to the land by other Ludlows, and by a fellow named Peter Demert, who claimed he could prove pretty convincingly that he was a Ludlow on the other side of the sheets. And Joseph Ludlow the Elder was money poor but land rich toward the end of his life, and every now and then he'd just gift somebody with 200 or 400 acres when he got into his cups. "Were none of those deeds recorded?" Lewis asked, fascinated in spite of himself. "Oh, they were regular bears for recording deeds, were our grandfathers," Judd said, lighting a new cigarette from the butt of the old one. "The original grant on your land goes like this." Judd closed his eyes and quoted, "From the great old maple which stands atop Quinsbury Ridge to the verge of Orrington Stream, thus runneth the track from north until south." Judd grinned without much humor. "But the great old maple fell down in 1882, let's say, and was rotted to moss by the year 1900. And Orrington Stream silted up and turned to marsh in the 10 years between the end of the Great War and the crash of the stock market. A nice mess it made. It ended up not mattering to old Anson anyways. He was struck and killed by lightning in 1921, right up around where that burying ground is." Lewis stared at Judd. Judd sipped his beer. "It don't matter. There's lots of places where the history of ownership is so tangled it never gets unraveled. Only the lawyers end up making money. Hell, Dickens knew that. I suppose the Indians will get it back in the end, and I think that's the way it should be. But that don't really matter, Lewis. I came over here tonight to tell you about Timmy Baterman and his dad."
"Who's Timmy Baterman?"
"Timmy Baterman was one of the 20 or so boys from Ludlow that went overseas to fight Hitler. He left in 1942. He came back in a box with a flag on the top of it in 1943. He died in Italy. His daddy, Bill Baterman, lived his whole life in this town. He about went crazy when he got the telegram, and then he quieted right down. He knew about the Micmac burying ground, you see. And he'd decided what he wanted to do."
The chill was back. Lewis stared at Judd for a long time, trying to read the lie in the old man's eyes. It was not there, but the fact of this story surfacing just now was damned convenient.
"Why didn't you tell me this that other night?" he said finally. After we did the cat, when I asked you if anyone had ever buried a person up there, you said no one ever had."
"Because you didn't need to know," Judd said.
"Now you do."
Lewis was silent for a long time.
"Was he the only one?"
"The only one I know of personally," Judd said gravely. "The only one to ever try it. I doubt that, Lewis. I doubt it very much. I'm kind of like the preacher in Ecclesiastes. I don't believe that there's anything new under the sun. Oh, sometimes the glitter they sprinkle over the top of a thing changes, but that's all. What's been tried once has been tried once before, and before, and before."
He looked down at his liver-spotted hands. In the living room, the clock softly chimed 12:30.
"I decided that a man in your profession is used to looking at symptoms and seeing the diseases underneath. And I decided I had to talk straight to you when Mortensen down at the funeral home told me you'd ordered a grave liner instead of a ceiling vault."
Lewis looked at Judd for a long time, saying nothing. Judd flushed deeply, but didn't look away. Finally, Lewis said, "Sounds like maybe you did a little snooping, Judd. I am sorry because of it.
I didn't ask him which you bought.
Not right out, maybe."
But Judd did not reply, and although his blush had deepened even more, his complexion was approaching a plum color now, his eyes still didn't waver. At last, Lewis sighed.
He felt unutterably tired. Oh, fuck it. I don't care. Maybe you're even right. Maybe it was on my mind. If it was, it was on the downside of it. I didn't think much about what I was ordering. I was thinking about Gage. I know you were thinking about Gage. But you knew the difference. Your uncle was an undertaker. Yes, he had known the difference. A ceiling vault was a piece of construction work, something which was meant to last a long, long time. Concrete was poured into a rectangular mold, reinforced with steel rods. And then, after the graveside services were over, a crane lowered a slightly curved concrete top into place. The lid was sealed with a substance like the hot patch highway departments used to fill potholes. Uncle Carl had told Lewis that sealant, trade name Everlock, got itself a fearsome grip after all that weight had been on it for a while. Uncle Carl, who liked to yarn as much as anyone, at least when he was with his own kind, and Lewis, who had worked with him summers for a while, qualified as a sort of apprentice undertaker, told his nephew of an exhumation order he'd gotten once from the Cook County DA's office. Uncle Carl went out to Groveland to oversee the exhumation. They could be tricky things, he said. People whose only ideas concerning disinterral came from those horror movies starring Boris Karloff as Dr. Frankenstein's monster and Dwight Fry as Igor had an entirely wrong impression. Opening a ceiling vault was no job for two men with picks and shovels, not unless they had about 6 weeks to spend on the job. This one went all right, at first. The grave was opened, and the crane grappled onto the top of the vault. Only the top didn't just pull off, as it was supposed to do. The whole vault, its concrete sides already a little wet and discolored, started to rise out of the ground instead. Uncle Carl screamed for the crane operator to back off. Uncle Carl wanted to go back to the mortuary and get some stuff that would weaken the sealant's grip a bit. The crane operator either didn't hear or wanted to go for the whole thing, just like a little kid playing with a toy crane and junk prizes in a penny arcade. Uncle Carl said that the damned fool almost got it, too. The vault was three-quarters of the way out. Uncle Carl and his assistant could hear water pattering from the underside of the vault onto the floor of the grave. It had been a wet week in Chicagoland, when the crane just tipped over and went kerplunk into the grave. The crane operator crashed into the windshield and broke his nose. That day's festivities cost Cook County roughly $3,000, $2,100 over the usual price of such gay goings-on. The real point of the story for Uncle Carl was that the crane operator had been elected president of a Chicago local of the Teamsters 6 years later. Grave liners were simpler matters. Such a liner was no more than a humble concrete box, open at the top. It was set into the grave on the morning of a funeral. Following the services, the coffin was lowered into it. The sextons then brought on the top, which was usually in two segments. These segments were lowered vertically into the ends of the grave, where they stood up like bookends. Iron rings were embedded into the concrete at the ends of each segment. The sextons would run lengths of chain through them and lower them gently onto the top of the grave liner. Each section would weigh 60, perhaps 70 pounds, 80 tops, and no sealer was used. It was easy enough for a man to open a grave liner. That's what Judd was implying. Easy enough for a man to disinter the body of his son and bury it someplace else. Shh, shh, we will not speak of such things. These are secret things. Yes, I guess I knew the difference between a ceiling vault and a grave liner, Lewis said. But I wasn't thinking about what you think I was thinking about. Lewis, it's late, Lewis said. It's late, I'm drunk, and my heart aches. If you feel like you have to tell me this story, then tell me and let's get it over with. Maybe I should have started with martinis, he thought. Then I could have been safely passed out when he came knocking. All right, Lewis. Thank you. Just go on. Judd paused a moment, thinking, then began to speak. 39. In those days, back during the war, I mean, the train still stopped in Arrington, and Bill Baterman had a funeral hack there at the loading depot to meet the freight carrying the body of his son, Timmy. The coffin was unloaded by four railroad men. I was one of them. There was an Army fellow on board from Graves and Registration. That was the Army's wartime version of Undertakers, Lewis. But he never got off the train. He was sitting drunk in a boxcar that still had 12 coffins in it. We put Timmy into the back of a mortuary Cadillac. In those days, it still wasn't uncommon to hear such things called hurry-up wagons, because in the old days, the major concern was to get them into the ground before they rotted. Bill Bateman stood by, his face stony and kind of, I don't know, kind of dry, I guess you'd say. He wept no tears. Huey Garber was driving the train that day, and he said that Army fella had really had a tour for himself. Huey said they'd flown in a whole shitload of those coffins to Limestone and Presque Isle, at which point both the coffins and their keeper and trained for points south. The Army fella comes walking up to Huey, and he takes a fifth of rye whiskey out of his uniform blouse, and he says in this soft, drawly, Dixie voice, "Well, Mr. Engineer, you're driving a mystery train today. Did you know that?" Huey shakes his head. "Well, you are. At least, that's what they call a funeral train down in Alabama." Huey says the fella took a list out of his pocket and squinted at it. "We're going to start by dropping two of those coffins off in Houlton. And then I've got one for Passadumkeag, two for Bangor, one for Derry, one for Ludlow, and so on. I feel like a fucking milkman. You want a drink?" Well, Huey declines the drink on the grounds that the Bangor and Aroostook is pretty fussy on the subject of train drivers with rye on their breaths. And the fellow from Graves and Registration don't hold it against Huey, any more than Huey holds the fact of the Army fellow's drunkenness against him. "They even shook on her," Huey said. So off they go, dropping those flag-covered coffins every other stop or two. 18 or 20 of them in all. Huey said it went on all the way to Boston. And there was weeping and wailing relatives at every stop except Ludlow. And at Ludlow, he was treated to the sight of Bill Bateman, who, he said, looked like he was dead inside and just waiting for his soul to stink. When he got off that train, he said he woke up that Army fella, and they hit some spots, 15 or 20, and Huey got drunker than he had ever been and went to a whore, which he'd never done in his whole life, and woke up with a set of crabs so big and mean they gave him the shivers. And he said that if that was what they called a mystery train, he never wanted to drive no mystery train again. Timmy's body was taken up to the Greenspan Funeral Home on Fern Street. It used to be across from where the new Franklin Laundry stands now. And 2 days later, he was buried in Pleasant View Cemetery with full military honors. Well, I tell you, Lewis, Mrs. Bateman was dead 10 years then, along with the second child she tried to bring into the world. And that had a lot to do with what happened. A second child might have helped to ease the pain, don't you think? A second child might have reminded old Bill that there's others that feel the pain and have to be helped through. I guess in that way you're luckier, having another child and all, I mean. A child and a wife are both alive and well. According to the letter Bill got from the lieutenant in charge of his boy's platoon, Timmy was shot down on the road to Rome on July 15, 1943. His body was shipped home 2 days later, and it got to Limestone on the 19th. It was put aboard Huey Garber's mystery train the very next day. Most of the GIs who got killed in Europe were buried in Europe, but all of the boys who went home on that train were special. Timmy had died charging a machine gun nest, and he had won the Silver Star posthumously. Timmy was buried. Don't hold me to this, but I think it was on July 22nd. It was 4 or 5 days later that Marjorie Washburn, who was the mailwoman in those days, saw Timmy walking up the road toward York's livery stable. Well, Marjorie damn near drove right off the road, and you can understand why. She went back to the post office, tossed her leather bag with all her undelivered mail still in it on George Anderson's desk, and told him she was going home and to bed right then. "Margie, are you sick?" George asks. "You were just as white as a gull's wing."
I've had the fright of my life, and I don't want to talk to you about it, Margie Washburn says. I ain't going to talk to Brian about it, or my mom, or anybody. When I get up to heaven, if Jesus asks me to talk to him about it, maybe I will. But I don't believe it. And out she goes. Everybody knew Timmy was dead. There was his obituary in the Bangor Daily News and the Ellsworth American just the week before. Picture and all. And half the town turned out for his funeral up to the city. And here Margie seen him walking up the road. Lurching up the road, she finally told George Anderson. Only this was 20 years later. And she was dying. And George told me it seemed to him like she wanted to tell somebody what she'd seen. George said it seemed to him like it preyed on her mind, you know. Pale he was, she said, and dressed in an old pair of chino pants and a faded flannel hunting shirt. Although it must have been 90 degrees in the shade that day. Margie said all his hair was sticking up in the back. His eyes were like raisins stuck in bread dough. I saw a ghost that day, George. That's what scared me so. I never thought I'd see such a thing, but there it was. Well, word got around. Pretty soon some other people saw Timmy, too. Mrs. Stratton. Well, we called her Mrs., but so far as anyone knew, she could have been single or divorced or grass-widowed. She had a little two-room house down where the Peterson Road joins the Hancock Road. And she had a lot of jazz records. And sometimes she'd be willing to throw you a little party if you had a $10 bill that wasn't working too hard. Well, she saw him from her porch, and she said he walked right up to the edge of the road and stopped there. He just stood there, she said, his hands dangling at his sides and his head pushed forward, looking like a boxer who's ready to eat him some canvas. She said she stood there on her porch, heart going like 60, too scared to move. Then she said he turned around, and it was like watching a drunk man try to do an about-face. One leg went way out, and the other foot turned, and he just about fell over. She said he looked right at her, and all the strength just run out of her hands, and she dropped the basket of washing she had, and the clothes fell out and got smutty all over again. She said his eyes... She said they looked as dead and dusty as marbles, Lewis. But he saw her, and he grinned, and she said he talked to her. Asked her if she still had those records, because he wouldn't mind cutting a rug with her. Maybe that very night. And Mrs. Stratton went back inside, and she wouldn't come out for most of a week, and by then it was over anyway. A lot of people saw Timmy Baterman. Many of them are dead now. Mrs. Stratton is, for one, and others have moved on. But there are a few old crocks like me left around who'll tell you if you ask him right. We saw him, I tell you, walking back and forth along the Peterson Road, a mile east of his daddy's house and a mile west. Back and forth he went. Back and forth all day. And for all anyone knew, all night. Shirt untucked. Pale face. Hair all stuck up in spikes. Fly unzipped sometimes. And this look on his face. This look... Judd paused to light a cigarette, then shook the match out and looked at Lewis through the haze of drifting blue smoke. And although the story was, of course, utterly mad, there was no lie in Judd's eyes. You know, they have these stories and these movies, I don't know if they're true, about zombies down in Haiti. In the movies, they just sort of shamble along with their dead eyes staring straight ahead real slow and sort of clumsy. Timmy Baterman was like that, Lewis. Like a zombie in a movie. But he wasn't. There was something more. There was something going on behind his eyes. And sometimes you could see it, and sometimes you couldn't see it. Something behind his eyes, Lewis. I don't think that thinking is what I want to call it. I don't know what in the hell I want to call it. It was sly, that was one thing. Like him telling Mrs. Stratton he wanted to cut a rug with her. There was something going on in there, Lewis. But I don't think it was thinking. And I don't think it had much, maybe nothing at all,
to do with Timmy Baterman. It was more like a radio signal that was coming from somewhere else. You looked at him and you thought, if he touches me, I'm going to scream. Like that. Back and forth he went, up and down the road, and one day after I got home from work, this must have been, I'm going to say it was July 30th or so, here is George Anderson, the postmaster, don't you know, sitting on my back porch, drinking iced tea with Hannibal Benson, who was then our second selectman, and Alan Purinton, who was fire chief. Norma sat there, too, but never said a thing. George kept rubbing the stump at the top of his right leg. Lost most of that leg working on the railroad, he did, and the stump used to bother him, something fierce on those hot and muggy days. But here he was, misery or not. "This has gone far enough," George says to me. "I got a mail woman who won't deliver out on the Peterson Road. That's one thing. It's starting to raise Cain with the government. And that's something else." "What do you mean it's raising Cain with the government?" I asked. "Hannibal said he'd had a call from the War Department. Some lieutenant named Kinsman, whose job it was to sort out malicious mischief from plain old tomfoolery. 4 or 5 people have written anonymous letters to the War Department, Hannibal says. And this Lieutenant Kinsman is starting to get a little bit concerned. If it was just one fellow who had written one letter, they'd laugh it off. If it was just one fellow writing a whole bunch of letters, Kinsman said he'd call the state police up in Derry Barracks and tell them they might have a psychopath with a hate on against the Baterman family in Ludlow. But these letters all came from different people." He said you could tell that by the handwriting, name or no name. "And they all say the same crazy thing. That if Timothy Baterman is dead, he makes one hell of a lively corpse walking up and down Peterson Road with his bare face hanging out. This Kinsman is going to send a fellow out or come himself if this don't settle down," Hannibal finishes up. "They want to know if Timmy's dead, or AWOL, or what, because they don't like to think their records are all at 6s and 7s. Also, they're gonna want to know who was buried in Timmy Baterman's box, if he wasn't." Well, you can see what kind of a mess it was, Lewis. We sat there most of an hour, drinking iced tea and talking it over. Norma asked us if we wanted sandwiches, but no one did. We talked it around and talked it around, and finally we decided we had to go out there to the Baterman place. I'll never forget that night, not if I lived to be twice as old as I am now. It was hot, hotter than the hinges of hell, with the sun going down like a bucket of guts behind the clouds. There was none of us wanted to go, but we had to. Norma knew it before any of us. She got me inside on some pretext or other and said, "Don't you let them dither around and put this off, Judson. You got to get this taken care of. It's an abomination." Judd measured Lewis evenly with his eyes. "That was what she called it, Lewis. It was her word. Abomination. And she kind of whispers in my ear, 'If anything happens, Judd, you just run. Never mind these others. They'll have to look out for themselves. You remember me and bust your hump right out of there if anything happens.'" We drove over in Hannibal Benson's car. That son of a bitch got all the 8 coupons he wanted. I don't know how. Nobody said much, but all 4 of us was smoking like chimbleys. We were scared, Lewis, just as scared as we could be. But the only one who really said anything was Alan Purinton. He says to George, "Bill Baterman has been up to Dickens in that woods north of Route 15, and I'll put my warrant to that." Nobody answered, but I remember George nodding his head. Well, we got there, and Alan knocked, but nobody answered. So we went around to the back, and there the two of them were. Bill Baterman was sitting there on his back stoop with a pitcher of beer, and Timmy was at the back of the yard, just staring up at that red, bloody sun as it went down. His whole face was orange with it, like he'd been flayed alive. And Bill, he looked like the devil had gotten him after his 7 years of highfalutin. He was floating in his clothes, and I judged he'd lost 40 pounds. His eyes had gone back in their sockets until they were like little animals in a pair of caves. And his mouth kept going tick, tick, tick on the left side. Judd paused, seemed to consider, and then nodded imperceptibly. Lewis? He looked damned. Timmy looked around at us and grinned. Just seeing him grin made you want to scream. Then he turned and went back to looking at the sun go down. Bill says, I didn't hear you boys knock. Which was a bald-faced lie, of course, since Alan laid on that door loud enough to wake up a deaf man. No one seemed like they was going to say anything, so I says, Bill, I heard your boy was killed over in Italy. That was a mistake, he says, looking right at me. Was it? I says. You see him standing right there, don't you? He says. So who do you reckon was in that coffin you had buried out at Pleasant View? Alan Purinton asks him. Be damned if I know, Bill says. And be damned if I care. He goes to get a cigarette and spills them all over the back porch, then breaks two or three trying to pick them up. Probably have to be an exhumation, Hannibal says. You know that, don't you? I had a call from the goddamn War Department, Bill. They are going to want to know if they buried some other mother's son under Timmy's name. Well, what in the hell of it? Bill says in a loud voice. That's nothing to me, is it? I got my boy. Timmy come home the other day. He's been shell-shocked or something. He's a little strange now, but he'll come around. Let's quit this, Bill, I says, and all at once I was pretty mad at him. If and when they dig up that army coffin, they're going to find it dead empty, unless you went to the trouble of filling it up with rocks after you took your boy out of it. And I don't think you did. I know what happened. Hannibal and George and Alan here know what happened. And you know what happened, too. You've been fooling around up in the woods, Bill, and you have caused yourself and this town a lot of trouble. You fellas know your way out, I guess, he says. I don't have to explain myself to you or justify myself to you or nothing. When I got that telegram, the life ran right out of me. I felt her go, just like piss down the inside of my leg. Well, I got my boy back. They had no right to take my boy. He was only 17. He was all I had left of his dear mother. And it was ill-fucking-legal. So fuck the army. And fuck the War Department. And fuck the United States of America. And fuck you boys, too. I got him back. He'll come around. And that's all I got to say. Now you all just march your boots back where you came from. And his mouth is tick-tick-ticking. And his sweat all over his forehead in big drops. And that was when I saw he was crazy. It would have driven me crazy, too, living with that thing. Lewis was feeling sick to his stomach. He had drunk too much beer too fast. Pretty soon it was all going to come up on him. The heavy, loaded feeling in his stomach told him it would be coming up soon. Well, there wasn't much else we could do. We got ready to go. Hannibal says, Bill, God help you. Bill says, God never helped me. I helped myself. That was when Timmy walked over to us. He even walked wrong, Lewis. He walked like an old man. He'd put one foot high up, and then bring it down, and then kind of shuffle, and then lift the other one. It was like watching a crab walk. His hands dangled down by his legs, and when he got close enough, you could see red marks across his face on the slant like pimples or little burns. I reckon that's where the Kraut machine gun got him. Must have damn near blowed his head off. And he stank of the grave. It was a black smell, like everything inside him was just lying there, spoiled. I saw Alan Purinton put a hand up to cover his nose and mouth. The stench was just awful. He almost expected to see grave maggots squirming around in his hair. Stop, Lewis said hoarsely. I've heard enough. You ain't, Judd said. He spoke with haggard earnestness. That's it, you ain't. and I can't even make it as bad as it was. Nobody could understand how bad it was unless they was there. He was dead, Lewis. But he was alive, too, and he knew things.
Knew things? Lewis sat forward.
He looked at Alan for a long time, kind of grinning. You could see his teeth, anyway. And then he spoke in this low voice. You felt like you had to strain forward to hear it. It sounded like he had gravel down in his tubes. Your wife is fucking that man she works with down at the drugstore, Purinton. What do you think of that? She screams when she comes. What do you think of that? Alan, he kind of gasped, and you could see it had hit him. Alan's in a nursing home up in Gardiner now, or was, the last I heard. He must be pushing 90. Back when all this happened, he was 40 or so, and there had been some talk around about his second wife. She was his second cousin, and she had come to live with Alan and Alan's first wife, Lucy, just before the war. Well, Lucy died, and a year and a half later, Alan up and married this girl. Loreen, her name was. She was no more than 24 when they married. And there had been some talk about her, you know. If you were a man, you might have called her ways sort of free and easy and let it go at that. But the women thought she might be loose. And maybe Alan had had a few thoughts in that direction, too. Because he says, shut up. Shut up or I'll knock you down, whatever you are. Shush now, Timmy, Bill says, and he looks worse than ever, you know. Like maybe he's going to puke or faint dead away or do both. You shush, Timmy. But Timmy didn't take no notice. He looks around at George Anderson and he says, that grandson you set such a store by is just waiting for you to die, old man. The money is all he wants. The money he thinks you got socked away in your lockbox at the Bangor Eastern Bank. That's why he makes up to you. But behind your back, he makes fun of you, him and his sister. Old wooden leg, that's what they call you, Timmy says. And Lewis, his voice, it changed. It got mean. It sounded like the way that grandson of George's would have sounded if, you know, if the things Timmy was saying was true. Old wooden leg, Timmy says. And won't they shit when they find out you're poor as a church mouse because you lost it all in 1938? Won't they shit, George? Won't they just shit? George, he backed away then, and his wooden leg buckled under him, and he fell back on Bill's porch and upset his pitcher of beer, and he was as white as your undershirt, Lewis. Bill, he gets him back on his feet somehow, and he's roaring at his boy, Timmy, you stop it, you stop it, but Timmy wouldn't. He said something bad about Hannibal, and then he said something bad about me, too. And by then he was raving, I'd say. Yeah, he was raving, all right, screaming. And we started to back away. And then we started to run, dragging George along the best we could by the arms because he'd gotten the straps and harnesses on that fake leg twisted somehow. And it was all off to one side with the shoe turned around backward and dragging on the grass. The last I seen of Timmy Baterman, he was on the back lawn by the clothesline, his face all red in the setting sun. Those marks standing out on his face, his hair all crazy and dusty somehow. And he was laughing and screeching over and over again. Old wooden leg, old wooden leg, and the cuckold, and the whoremaster. Goodbye, gentlemen. Goodbye, goodbye. And then he laughed, but it was screaming, really. Something inside him, screaming, and screaming, and screaming.
Judd stopped. His chest moved up and down rapidly.
Judd, Lewis said,
the thing this Timmy Baterman told you, was it true?
It was true, Judd muttered. Christ, it was true. I used to go to a whorehouse in Bangor betimes. Nothing many a man hasn't done, although I suppose there are plenty that walk the straight and narrow. I just would get the urge, the compulsion, maybe, to sink it into strange flesh now and then.
or pay some woman to do the things a man can't bring himself to ask his wife to do. Men keep their gardens too, Lewis. It wasn't a terrible thing, but I done. And all of that has been behind me for the last 8 or 9 years. And Norma would not have left me if she had known. But something in her would have died forever. Something dear and sweet.
Judd's eyes were red and swollen and bleary. The tears of the old are singularly unlovely, Lewis thought. But when Judd groped across the table for Lewis's hand, Lewis took it firmly.
He told us only the bad, he said after a moment. Only the bad. God knows there is enough of that in any human being's life, isn't there?
2 or 3 days later, Lorraine Purinton left Ludlow for good. And folks in town who saw her before she got on the train said she was sporting 2 shiners and had cotton stuffed up both bores of her pump. Alan, he would never talk about it. George died in 1950. And if he left anything to that grandson and granddaughter of his, I never heard about it. Hannibal got kicked out of office because of something that was just like what Timmy Baterman accused him of. I won't tell you exactly what it was. You don't need to know, but misappropriation of town funds for his own use comes close enough to cover it, I reckon. There was even talk of trying him on embezzlement charges, but it never came to much. Losing the post was enough punishment for him anyway. His whole life was playing the big cheese. But there was good in those men, too. That's what I mean. That's what folks always find it so hard to remember. It was Hannibal got the fund started for the Eastern General Hospital right before the war. Ellen Purinton was one of the most generous, open-handed men I ever knew. And old George Anderson only wanted to go on running the post office forever. It was only the bad it wanted to talk about, though. It was only the bad it wanted us to remember because it was bad. And because it knew we meant danger for it. The Timmy Baterman that went off to fight the war was a nice, ordinary kid, Lewis. Maybe a little dull, but good-hearted. The thing we saw that night, looking up into that red sun, that was a monster. Maybe it was a zombie. Or a dibbuk. Or a demon. Maybe there's no name for such a thing as that, but the Micmacs would have known what it was, name or no.
What? Lewis said numbly.
Something that had been touched by the Wendigo, Judd said evenly. He took a deep breath, held it for a moment, let it out, and looked at his watch.
Well, a day. The hour's late, Lewis. I've talked 9 times as much as I meant to.
I doubt that, Lewis said. You've been very eloquent. Tell me how it came out.
There was a fire at the Bateman place 2 nights later, Judd said. The house burned flat. Ellen Purinton said there was no doubt about the fire being set. Range oil had been splashed from one end of that little house to the other. You could smell the reek of it for 3 days after the fire was out.
So they both burned up.
Oh, yeah, they burned. But they was dead beforehand. Timmy was shot twice in the chest with a pistol Bill Baterman kept handy, an old Colt's. They found it in Bill's hand. What he'd done, or so it looked like, was to kill his boy, lay him on the bed, and then spill out that range oil. They sat down in his easy chair by the radio, flicked a match, and ate the barrel of that Colt 45.
Jesus, Lewis said.
They were pretty well charred, but the county medical examiner said it looked to him like Timmy Baterman had been dead 2 or 3 weeks.
Silence ticking out. Judd got up.
I wasn't exaggerating when I said I might have killed your boy, Lewis, or had a hand in it. The Micmacs knew that place, but that doesn't necessarily mean they made it what it was. The Micmacs weren't always here. They came maybe from Canada, maybe from Russia, maybe from Asia, way back in the beginning.
They stayed here in Maine for 1,000 years, or maybe it was 2,000. It's hard to tell, because they did not leave their mark deep on the land. And now they are gone again. Same way we'll be gone someday. Although I guess our mark will go deeper, for better or worse. But the place will stay, no matter who's here, Lewis. It isn't as though someone owned it and could take its secret when they moved on. It's an evil, curdled place, and I had no business taking you up there to bury that cat. I know that now. It has a power you'll beware of if you know what's good for your family and what's good for you. I wasn't strong enough to fight it. You saved Narma's life, and I wanted to do something for you. And that place turned my good wish to its own evil purpose. It has a power, and I think that power goes through phases, same as the moon. It's been full of power before, and I'm as scared it's coming around to fall again. I'm as scared it used me to get at you through your son. Do you see, Lewis, what I'm getting at? His eyes pleaded with Lewis. You're saying the place knew Gage was going to die, I think, Lewis said. No, I am saying the place might have made Gage die because I introduced you to the power in the place. I am saying I may have murdered your son with good intentions, Lewis. I don't believe it, Lewis said at last, shakily. Didn't. Wouldn't. Couldn't. He held Judd's hand tightly. We're burying Gage tomorrow, in Bangor. And in Bangor he will stay. I don't plan to go up there to the pet cemetery or beyond it ever again. Promise me, Judd said harshly. Promise. I promise, Lewis said. But in the back of his mind, contemplation remained, a dancing flicker of promise that would not quite go away. 40. But none of those things happened. All of them. The droning Orinco truck, the fingers that just touched the back of Gage's jumper and then slid off. Rachel preparing to go to the viewing in her housecoat. Ellie carrying Gage's picture and putting his chair next to her bed. Steve Masterton's tears. The fight with Irwin Goldman. Judd Crandall's terrible story of Timmy Baterman. All of them existed only in Lewis Creed's mind during the few seconds that passed while he raced his laughing son to the road. Behind him, Rachel screamed again, Gage, come back, don't run! But Lewis did not waste his breath. It was going to be close, very close, and yes, one of those things really happened. From somewhere up the road, he could hear the drone of the oncoming truck, and somewhere inside, a memory circuit opened, and he could hear Judd Crandall speaking to Rachel on that very first day in Ludlow. You want to watch him around the road, Mrs. Creed. It's a bad road for kids and pets. Now Gage is running down the gentle slope of lawn that merged with the soft shoulder of Route 15, his husky little legs pumping. And by all the rights of the world, he should have fallen over, sprawling. But he just kept going, and now the sound of the truck was very loud indeed. It was that low, snoring sound that Lewis sometimes heard from his bed as he floated just beyond the rim of sleep. Then it seemed a comforting sound, but now it terrified him. Oh, my dear God, oh, my dear Jesus, let me catch him. Don't let him get into the road. Lewis put on a final burst of speed and leaped, throwing himself out straight and parallel to the ground like a football player about to make a tackle. He could see his shadow tracking along on the grass below him in the lowest periphery of his vision, and he thought of the kite, the vulture, printing its shadow all the way across Mrs. Vinton's field. And just as Gage's forward motion carried him into the road, Lewis's fingers brushed the back of his jacket, and then snagged it. He yanked Gage backward and landed on the ground at the same instant, crashing his face into the rough gravel of the shoulder, giving himself a bloody nose. His ball signaled a much more serious flash of pain. Ooh, if I'd have known I was going to be playing football, I would have worn my jock. But both the pain in his nose and the driving agony in his testes were lost in the swelling relief of hearing Gage's wail of pain and outrage as his bottom landed on the shoulder, and he fell over backward onto the edge of the lawn, thumping his head. A moment later, his wails were drowned by the roar of the passing truck and the almost regal blat of its air horn. Lewis managed to get up in spite of the lead ball sitting in his lower stomach and cradled his son in his arms. A moment later, Rachel joined them, also weeping, crying out to Gage, "Never run on the road, Gage. Never, never, never. The road is bad, bad." And Gage was so astonished at this tearful lecture that he left off crying and goggled up at his mother. "Lewis, your nose is bleeding," she said, and then hugged him so suddenly and strongly that for a moment he could barely breathe. "That isn't the worst of it," he said. "I think I'm sterile, Rachel. Oh, boy, the pain." And she laughed so hysterically that for a few moments he was frightened for her, and the thought crossed his mind, if Gage really had been killed, I believe it would have driven her crazy. But Gage was not killed. All of that had only been a hellishly detailed moment of imagination as Lewis outraced his son's death across a green lawn on a sunshiny May afternoon. Gage went to grammar school. At the age of 7, he began going to camp, where he showed a wonderful and surprising aptitude for swimming. He also gave his parents a rather glum surprise by proving himself able to handle a month's separation with no noticeable psychic trauma. By the time he was 10, he was spending the entire summer away at Camp Agawam in Raymond. At 11, he won 2 blue ribbons and a red one at the Four Camps Swimathon that ended the summer's activities. He grew tall, and yet through it all, he was the same Gage, sweet and rather surprised at the things the world held out. And for Gage, the fruit was somehow never bitter or rotten. He was an honors student in high school and a member of the swimming team at John Babst, the parochial school he had insisted on attending because of its swimming facilities. Rachel was upset, Lewis not particularly surprised, when at 17, Gage announced his intention to convert to Catholicism. Rachel believed that all of it was because of the girl Gage was going out with. She saw marriage in his immediate future. "If that little slut with the St. Christopher's medal isn't balling him, I'll eat your shorts, Lewis," she said. The wreckage of his college plans and his Olympic hopes, and 9 or 10 little Catholics running around by the time Gage was 40. By then he would be, according to Rachel anyway, a cigar-smoking truck driver with a beer belly, our fathering and Hail Marying his way into pre-cardiac oblivion. Lewis suspected his son's motives were rather more pure, and although Gage converted, and on the day he actually did the deed, Lewis sent an unabashedly nasty postcard to Irwin Goldman. It read, "Perhaps you'll have a Jesuit grandson yet. Your goy son-in-law, Lewis." He did not marry the rather nice and decidedly unslutty girl he had dated through most of his senior year. He went on to Johns Hopkins, made the Olympic swimming team, and on one long, dazzling, and incredibly proud afternoon, 16 years after Lewis had raced an Orinco truck for his son's life, he and Rachel, who had now gone almost entirely gray, although she covered it with a rinse, watched their son win a gold medal for the USA. When the NBC cameras moved in for a close-up of him, standing with his dripping, seal-sleek head back, his eyes open and calm and fixed on the flag as the national anthem played, the ribbon around his neck and the gold lying against the smooth skin of his chest, Lewis wept. He and Rachel both wept. "I guess this caps everything," he said huskily and turned to embrace his wife. But she was looking at him with dawning horror, her face seeming to age before his eyes as if whipped by days and months and years of evil time. The sound of the national anthem faded, and when Lewis looked back at the TV, he saw a different boy there, a black boy with a head of tight curls in which gems of water still gleamed. "This caps everything. His cap. His cap is... Oh, dear God, his cap is full of blood." Lewis woke up in the cold, dead light of a rainy 7 o'clock, clutching his pillow in his arms. His head thumped monstrously with his heartbeat. The ache swelled and faded, swelled and faded. He burped acid that tasted like old beer, and his stomach heaved miserably. He had been weeping. The pillow was wet with his tears, as if he had somehow stumbled in and then out of one of those hokey country and western laments in his sleep. Even in the dream, he thought, some part of him had known the truth and had cried for it. He got up and stumbled to the bathroom, heart racing threadily in his chest, consciousness itself fragmented by the fierceness of his hangover. He reached the toilet bowl barely in time and threw up a glut of last night's beer. He kneeled on the floor, eyes closed until he felt capable of actually making it to his feet. He groped for the handle and flushed the John. He went to the mirror to see how badly bloodshot his eyes were, but the glass had been covered with a square of sheeting. Then he recalled. Drawing almost randomly on a past she professed to barely remember, Rachel had covered all the mirrors in the house, and she took off her shoes before entering through the door. No Olympic swimming team, Lewis thought dully as he walked back to his bed and sat down on it. The sour taste of beer coated his mouth and throat, and he swore to himself, not for the first time or the last, that he would never touch that poison again. No Olympic swimming team. No 3.0 in college. No little Catholic girlfriend or conversion. No Camp Agawam. No nothing. His sneakers had been torn off. His jumper turned inside out. His sweet little boy's body, so tough and sturdy, nearly dismembered. His cap had been full of blood. Now, sitting on his bed in the grip of this numbing hangover, rainwater spilling its lazy courses down the window beside him, his grief came for him fully, like some gray matron from Ward 9 in Purgatory. It came and dissolved him, unmanned him, took away whatever defenses remained, and he put his face in his hands and cried, rocking back and forth on his bed, thinking he would do anything to have a second chance. Anything at all.